The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Paul McLoone here for Culture Club, and I've just realised it's 25 years that you've been the lead singer of the Undertones.
I know. You get less for murder, Matt.
25 years. And you're playing the Night and Day Festival.
We are, yeah. We're doing... lovely to be here, by the way. Thanks very much
for
having
me. Great to have you, yeah.
Yeah, we're doing a bunch of festivals and stuff before we get into... It's kind of an upside-down year, really, in a way, because last year was busier earlier in the year, or maybe busier the whole way through the year. But this year's been kind of quiet, but now, as we get into summer, we're going to be doing a whole series of festivals. And then in the autumn, we're doing some serious... UK and Europe tour. And so the festivals are great, though, you know, because you always have a good experience, I think, generally.
The Night and Day Festival is on at Lochkey Forest Park in Boyle in County Roscommon the last weekend in June.
Yes.
And I believe there are still tickets from nightandday.ie/tickets. But what's in an Undertone set now? How long do you play for? How many songs? Because you were the sort of the masters of the 3-minute songs, weren't you?
3 minutes?
How dare you? Too long.
For the festivals, you sort of cut your cloth, you know what I mean? At one of our own club shows, if you like, we'd do maybe 90 minutes and sometimes we'd get up to 30 songs in there, you know? But for the festivals, it tends to be shorter sets, depending on the time slot, depending on the type of festival it is. So I imagine for this one, we'll be doing, I'd say, an hour tops. So, you know, you get all the hits and more. You know, the great thing about the Undertones is, if you don't like the song we're playing now, it'll be over really rather quickly. The downside of it is it might sound remarkably like the next song, but you know.
How much of a buzz do you still get out of appearing, being on stage, being the front man?
I still enjoy it hugely, you know, and I really wouldn't be doing it if I didn't, you know. I'm at that kind of point in my life where I'm kind of old and grumpy and I don't do things now unless I really enjoy them.
You're not that old.
No, I'm not, but you know, it helps to get ready. So, we're all in the same kind of boat on that one, you know. We're all doing it because we enjoy it. We're doing it, certainly not doing it to get rich or anything like that at this point. So we do it because it's fun. We believe in the songs. People get a buzz out of them. And it's nice to be asked to do things. Do you know what I mean? It's really nice to be asked to come along and play in Boyle at the festival. You know, we're always very, very flattered. And as I say, these things, 9 times out of 10, they're a great experience for all concerned, hopefully for the audience as well. But you're always very well looked after and made to feel very welcome, and you know, they make a bit of a fuss about you, so it's always good.
I'm sure there are plenty of people listening going, there he is again, he's back, we can hear Paul McLoone on Today FM. Let's go for your musical choices in the Culture Club.
Yes.
Your first musical choice, the first single that you can remember buying.
Yeah, I definitely remember buying it, and I remember exactly where I bought it, and I remember the day, and I remember the whole business of buying it.
Tell
it was
us.
Stand and Deliver by Adam and the Ants. So I already had the album Kings of the Wild Frontier. So 1981, we're going back a long way here, when even I was young, Matt. And 1981 was the big year of Adam and the Ants. But they'd kind of emerged on the scene in the latter part of 1980, certainly in terms of pop music. Now, Adam Ant, to explain, was one of the punk old guard. He was one of the originators, the whole London punk thing. So he was a contemporary of Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious and all those guys. In fact, the very first Pistols gig was as support to Adam Ant's old band, which was actually Adam Ant's Bazooka Joe was the band. It was Adam Ant's kind of Road to Damascus moment, because the Pistols just blew him away. So he went, oh, we're playing old kind of pub rock covers and whatever. We're completely on the wrong track. This is the future. This is where we got to go. So that was the first Pistols show supporting Adam Ant's band, Bazooka Joe, what they were at the time. So fast forward 4 years later, and he's become the biggest pop star of the early part of the 1980s. And it's a remarkable kind of transformation, musically, artistically, and certainly in terms of image. Of course, I wasn't wholly aware of all this at the time. I just thought he was really, really cool. So the whole image was this kind of mix of pirates and Native American and cowboy. And by the time Stand and Deliver came along, obviously, Highwayman, he'd managed to work Highwayman into the mix as well. So it was a heady mix for 13 and 14 year olds at the time, I think. You can see why it was so huge, you know.
Let's hear a bit of Adam and the Ants, Stand and Deliver.
I'm the Danny Hyman, and you're too scared to mention.
that. That would be my interest search here.
Don't rub it in.
Adamant, Stand and Deliver. Okay, favourite album?
Favourite album, yeah, this is a no-brainer for me because it's always really, for years now, it's been at my number one position, and it's Low by David Bowie. I just think there's nothing like it. Even for Bowie, it's kind of unique and strange, and Bowie rarely repeated himself anyway, but there was a kind of a through line to certain sort of periods of his work. But Low sort of stands alone. It's often lumped in with Heroes and Lodger and called fairly inaccurately the Berlin Trilogy because, you know, neither Low nor Lodger were actually recorded in Berlin at all. But anyway, that's another story. But Low is kind of its own unique thing as well. It is part of that experimental phase that he went through, working alongside Brian Eno, of course, and the great Tony Visconti, who often gets sort of slightly airbrushed out of the whole history of things. Very, very important producer. But Low is a really unique record. In terms of how his songwriting was, in terms of his approach, very experimental, bringing in a lot of European influences, Kraftwerk and Cluster and Noi, all these bands that I subsequently got into later because of Low. And he, in that very David Bowie way he had, he just takes all these slightly disparate kind of influences and molds them all together and synthesizes it into this new kind of thing. And he was very open about that. He always, you know, it was... People used to throw brickbats at Bowie going, well, he's always copying people or he's nicked all his ideas from everybody else. He's always said, yeah, I did. But it's what you do with them, you know, and it's how you combine them and what you come up with out of that mix. And I think Low's a great example of him achieving that really successfully, artistically.
From Low, here's Sound and Vision. Over Bowie music.
We did. That's actually completely true. When I first met with Ian to discuss becoming his producer, which is how I came to Today FM and how I came to Dublin, also 25 years ago, funnily enough. Yes, it was a big bonding thing, absolutely, 100%. And we were both lucky enough as well to go see him here in Dublin, not far from the original location of Today FM on Abbey Street. The venue that is now the Academy was called HQ back then. And we're talking a long time ago, boys and girls. But Bowie actually played there, a kind of a, not a secret gig, but a very hard to get into gig. And we managed to get in.
And what was he like live?
It was one of three times I saw him live. It was so intimate though. The other times were big large scale concerts. So this was very, very different. That's a small room to see David Flippin' Bowie, and we were very close to him, and he was doing a very kind of. He was doing a very sort of pared down kind of show. It wasn't at all theatrical. There was no big crazy effects or anything. It was just him and a bunch of songs that he wanted to play and a small band. So it was a very different kind of experience to the other times I'd seen him. But it was just incredible just to be, and you know, you say be in the same room as, you really felt like, yeah, this is being in the same room as properly because it's, you know, not a big room and we're very close to him. So it was just stunning, really. I still think about it a lot, you know.
Yeah. Favourite band or artist you're giving us?
Lou Reed and, the band, The Velvet Underground, and artist Lou Reed. They're you know, obviously Lou Reed was in The Velvet Underground, so they're kind of part of the same answer, really.
Why so? Why are you picking Lou Reed out?
Because, I guess, as I got older and became more into music in a serious kind of way, and hopefully not in a pole-faced, boring sort of way, but in a more seriously sort of involved way. I, with a certain degree of inevitability, encountered the Velvet Underground, because in the 1980s, just as I was coming into around 17 or 18, the Velvet Underground, who had actually split up in 1970, began to reemerge for a couple of reasons. There was a compilation album that came out of old unreleased stuff called VU. There was also a South Bank show about the band. And there was also a box set of their first three albums, which up to that point were quite hard to get your hands on. So all these things happened around 1985, 86, just as I was turning 18. And it just blew my mind, especially the first Velvet Underground album and tracks like Venus and Furs and Heroin. And it just absolutely blew my mind. I was aware of Lou Reed, obviously, through his subsequent work with Bowie, actually. Bowie's a bit of a thread running through things here, as we'll soon establish. But Lou Reed's solo stuff, obviously, I was a bit more aware of. But the Velvet Underground I were this kind of slightly mysterious thing. I'd heard bits and pieces, but I hadn't owned albums. So that all changed around then. And I began to realise how influential the Velvet Underground, and therefore Lou Reed as the songwriter with the band, the main songwriter with the band, how influential they were, how many bands, even bands that you wouldn't immediately think, like the Smiths. I mean, there were obvious kind of bands like the Jesus and Mary Chain who were doing the Velvet Underground thing, not in a bad way, but I mean, it was a lot more obvious with them. But even more subtly, Johnny Marr's work in the Smiths, you could hear echoes of the Velvet Underground's approach to guitars and stuff, and that energy that they had. And obviously the Bowie influence and everything as well, because he was very influenced by Lou and the Velvets. So it was kind of, it was a bit like graduating musically.
Let's hear a little bit of Lou Reed singing one of his best-known tracks, Perfect Day.
Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. Me forget myself. I thought I was someone else, someone good.
Shame to come back in on that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's become ubiquitous, really, in more recent years, but it's just...
But that's because the BBC did a montage,
that's right,
didn't they, with lots of different
artists.
That's
right, yeah, for was it the license fee or something? I can't remember. It was something like that. And it was released for charity, but I think initially it was to kind of go, hey, it's BBC, we're great, which is fair enough. They got all those guys to do that. But yeah, Perfect Day, I mean, that track alone, if he'd only done that and Walking the Wild Side and the Transformer album, we'd still be talking about Lou Reed. But of course, he went on to do many, many other things there, once again, in cahoots with Bowie and the great Mick Ronson, who arranged those strings, a beautiful string arrangement on that song. That's the brilliant Mick Ronson, David Bowie's guitar player and musical genius, really. But yeah, Lou never compromised. I think that's what I loved about him. He influenced everybody, and he was a difficult man by all accounts. I never got to meet him. But he never sold out. I love guys like that.
Now, you've been at many gigs, countless gigs, apart from the ones you've performed in yourself.
Yes.
What's the favourite you're going to nominate?
God, I thought about this I really ruminated over this one probably more than the others, because there have been so, so many, and it's really impossible. So I eventually just thought, what was the first thing came into your head when you looked at that question? So I just went with that, because I think, well, it must be at least half true. And it is, because 2016, I was lucky enough back then, thanks to a record PR guy here in Dublin called Pete Murphy, who's a great guy. Anyway, he got me and my producer Kate Brennan Harding then on the Today FM show. He got us into the gig in the Albert Hall in London, and it was Iggy Pop doing The Idiot and Lust for Life, those two key Iggy Pop solo albums, again produced by David Bowie, and he was doing them in their entirety along with this supergroup. So the drummer from Arctic Monkeys and Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age and a couple of his buddies from Queens of the Stone, they were the band, and there was Iggy, and we were right down the front, and it was just, it was completely, completely out of body, mad experience. I've never been at a gig like it, and Iggy was on fire that night. He was absolutely astonishing. I've seen him many times. I've seen him with the Stooges. I've seen him solo, and he's always good value. But my God, he was at a different level that night.
We have a little bit from that very gig, Lust for Life. Iggy Pop. Choice of Paul McLuhan's best gig he's ever been at.
And you know what?
Yes.
If you buy the live album of that, right, and you study the artwork, I made the, as it turns out, unfortunate sartorial decision that evening to wear a black and white striped Breton top and wear my glasses. And I'm so far down the front that I'm in all the pictures of the audience. It's like, where's Wally? Except it's
frontman
right
manages
there.
To get himself into the photographs. Favorite movie actor or director?
Oh, favorite movie. I thought that was favorite movie actor or director. So I only thought of favorite movie.
That's fine. That'll do us.
Which is Jaws. I have an unhealthy, possibly unhealthy relationship with Jaws. I think I've seen it more than any other film. Because it's endlessly fascinating to me, and not because it's about a big monstrous shark that eats people, and it's not really a gore movie. It's not really a kind of a horror. I mean, there's suspense and horror in it, but what's fascinating about Jaws is the human kind of characters, and Roy Scheider's character particularly, who's Brady, the police chief in it, Martin Brady, and. It's almost like the first half of it's almost like a Western. There's this big danger that's out there. The townsfolk are sort of oblivious to it. The mayor's kind of corrupt and he doesn't want to close the beaches, but the good sheriff and a couple of his friends know that the great danger is there and it must be dealt with, you know, and it kind of echoes a few of the classic Westerns almost that way. And then the three guys get in the boat and go out to take out the shark. I know that's not really very politically correct these days. It's not how it would, really happen anymore, but they go and they do it. And it's just great. And I love the way Spielberg approached the movie. You know, he's out on the water, which was a really stupid thing to do, a really silly thing apparently as a filmmaker to even attempt to do, but he did it anyway. And of course, it's one of the reasons that the film really works. The shark, the automated kind of artificial shark that they used, obviously this is 1975, technology wasn't what it is today. These days you do it all with CG, but brilliantly they did it practically. Some of it looks its age, to be fair, but it's the characters and the relationship between the characters that really makes it tick.
Okay, I'm going to move on. And a favourite play?
Well, you see, I was kind of stumped a wee bit when it came to plays, Matt, to be honest with you, because I've studied plays and I've read plays, but I've not been to an awful great number of plays, really, to be honest. It's not one of my strengths, culturally speaking. But I was lucky enough to see the London production of Lazarus. The last thing Bowie, yes, him again. The last thing
you're a bit obsessed, aren't you?
Well, no, you know what? I only realised when we started going through all this. He's everywhere.
In your life?
His tendrils are throughout popular culture, Matt. You only have to dig a little and you find them.
Continue telling me about Lazarus.
So Lazarus is the last thing Bowie's done after, you know, well, Black Star obviously was the last album that he put out, but the last project that he saw to fruition in his lifetime was Lazarus. And it's a sequel to the movie he made in the 70s with Nicholas Roeg, The Man Who Fell to Earth, where Bowie plays an alien who's come to Earth in a mission to try and save his dying planet. In the process, he ends up stranded here and in the movie ends up actually becoming a rock star. So there's like obviously allegory to Bowie's own life there as well. But for years, Bowie harbored the ambition to do some sort of sequel to it. And with the help of our own Enda Walsh, he managed to bring that to fruition. So I thought I'd never get a chance to actually see it because it was theatres only and it was in New York. But it did come to London for a run at a kind of a pop-up theatre in King's Cross. So I got a chance to see it and it was brilliant.
From Lazarus, here's Sophia Ann Caruso singing Life on Mars. This is from the King's Cross Theatre in London.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, and her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a saddening bore, for she's lived it 10 times or more.
It's so Broadway.
Isn't it just I was thinking?
Oh, man, beating up the wrong guy. I love it. It was an amazing thing to see. And Michael C. Hall, Dexter, played the lead, played David Bowie's old part in it. And he sang a bunch of tunes as well. It was very, very good. It's hard to describe as a story. It's very kind of open to interpretation, really. He's on his own and he's kind of in this beautiful apartment and he doesn't go out and he's a bit of a recluse and he's trying to find a way back home. And I won't give too much away. Hopefully, I know it must have all been filmed and videoed. Maybe we'll all get to see it on video someday, but an amazing production.
A favourite book?
Now, one of my favourite books, I read a lot of books about music.
There's a surprise.
Yeah, I know. funny that. I tend to read a lot of I read my fair share of fiction, but I tend to lean more towards biography, history, non-fiction stuff. And one of my favourite music books is by John Savage, who's a great writer, great music journalist, and a brilliant pop culture kind of commentator. Tremendous, tremendous talent as a writer. And he wrote, I think it was back in 1991, England's Dreaming, which was his account of the Sex Pistols and the genesis of the British, the English, I guess, because it was English, original punk movement. And he was one of the first writers, I think, to make a serious, hefty attempt to analyze it from a pop culture perspective and put it in its context, in a way that maybe hadn't been done. There have been books written about punk, obviously. There was a lot of sensationalist sort of stuff about punk. But by the 90s, I think people were starting to get more of an analytical perspective on it. And it's one of the greatest books, not only about punk, but one of the greatest books about popular culture.
Let's hear a little bit from it.
Myths and dreams play a large part in McLaren's life as he adheres to the first pop lore of Andrew Lou Goldham. I believe that if you lie enough, it becomes a reality. McLaren's fantasies, or even his half-lies, are as revealing as the truth. As he has managed to turn many of his fantasies into reality, it is worth giving them credence. This is, after all, pop, the modern Hollywood, the one place in English society where you can reinvent yourself, where the donning of a new jacket can appear a political act. Never forget that clothes are the things in England that make your heart beat, he says. There's a constant attempt to step out of that class structure of the two-piece suit. For all the propaganda of classlessness, whether the 60s pop cult model or the 80s entrepreneurial model, England is a highly static society with a strongly defined ruling class and a narrow definition of the acceptable. If you fall outside it for any reason, you're marginal. As with any cluster of minorities, if you put them together, you make a majority. Pop, a marginal industry in itself, is a place where many of them meet, as dreamers and misfits from all classes, to transform, if not the world, then their world.
Okay, that's from England's Dreaming, the Sex Pistols and Punk Rock by John Savage. We haven't much time left.
Okay.
I'm amazed that you're not nominating as your favourite childhood TV show, Top of the Pops.
Yeah, you know, I didn't think of that. You're right, it probably is.
You've gone with Star Trek.
I just loved Star Trek when I was growing up, and I mean Star Trek with the old wobbly effects, not these kind of digital ones that look like they were done on somebody's phone, the only way you can see it these days. Because I still watch the reruns, you know, for the old nostalgic kind of hit. But I love Star Trek. Who didn't? You know, it was so kind of... And it was Doctor Who as well, of course. But Doctor Who, even as a child, you could tell they hadn't spent an awful lot of money on it. And Star Trek was American, and it was much slicker, and you know, the costumes were great, and the stories were just fantastic, and it had that kind of monster of the week element to it. I loved it. Loved Star Trek. Still do.
I love your list of adult ones. You've named one that hasn't come up very often, but I loved, which was Watchmen.
Yeah, that was really an interesting approach as well, because Watchmen started life as a graphic novel, of course, as we know, the Alan Moore novel, which was then adapted, and as is often the case with Alan Moore adaptations, actually ran afoul of the author himself, because they, not to give anything away, but they basically made a very profound change to the ending in terms of the meaning of the ending. So Watchmen is a HBO series that picks up as a sequel, not to the film, but to the graphic novel. So you don't have to have read it, but it helps a lot if you've read it in order to enjoy the HBO miniseries. But it just takes the ideas of Watchmen and kind of puts them in a modern setting in a brilliant, brilliant, visionary kind of way.
Okay, you also have Ripley, and I don't have time to talk to you about it, unfortunately.
Great.
We ask everyone to conclude with a buried treasure, and you have come up with a Scottish band that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, so the band are the Bathers, and to be honest with you, I don't know an awful lot about them myself because they're so obscure. They're one of those bands like the Blue Nile or Prefab Spread or whatever. They've got their fan base, but in terms of profile, they make the Blue Nile look like Led Zeppelin. You
okay,
know,
but hold on, you can tell us more because I want to hear what they have.
Sometimes I used to fly away at night on the wings of an old love song. Somehow I used to feel that I was weak. I grew strong, and nothing was left. I called your name, you called my name. Tooled out among those roads like provincial sun. Will we be strong enough to carry on? Oh no, 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 I'll be waiting for you.
Tell us a little bit more in 30 seconds about them.
Chris Thompson, he's one of those kind of hopeless romantics who makes hopelessly romantic music for hopeless romantics to be hopelessly romantic too. The UK has thrown up a whole bunch of them, particularly in the 80s. They started in the 80s, but they're so hard to get your hands on those records. But do, they're the Bathers, and you won't regret it. Fantastic band.
Okay, Paul McLoon, it has been great having you here with us.
Great to be here, thank you.
And it's great to know that you're still going strong with the Undertones playing again, remind us.
We are Night and Day Festival, and it's the Saturday after next we're playing.
Okay, that is the 28th or 29th or whatever, 29th of June. Paul McLoon, thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.